Welcome to the Frank Reactions podcast, where we discuss how you can get great reactions from your staff, your customers, prospects, and the public through better customer experiences online and off. My name is Temma Frank. If you've already heard my blurb about how we've been transitioning from Frank Online Marketing to Frank Reactions, feel free to just skip ahead to about the 2-minute mark. Otherwise, listen on. We've been transitioning gradually from the Frank Online Marketing Show to the Frank Reactions podcast over the last few weeks, but there's a fair amount of overlap because many of the companies that I interviewed on that show were being successful online because of how they were handling customer experience related issues. So I think there's a lot of insight there that listeners to this podcast can also benefit from. What I've decided to do is for the first few episodes, I'm actually going to replay some of the ones from Frank Online Marketing that really deal a fair bit with customer experience related issues. So if you are a longtime listener of the Frank Online Marketing Show and have already heard all those, I would suggest you just skip right ahead to episode 15, which is where we will have totally new, fresh content for you. If you're interested, particularly in the online marketing side of things, I'd also suggest that you go back to the Frank Online Marketing Show and check out those episodes because there's a lot of real value in those as well. So next up is today's interview, and I hope that I'll get some feedback from you about what you think. I'd really be grateful if you would do a review on iTunes. It would be really exciting if we could get listed in their new and noteworthy column. And it would also be gratifying for me just to know that you're out there listening and to hear some of what you have to say about the show, because I am always looking for ways to make it better. Here we go. I came across an article the other day in User Experience magazine by a woman named Sarah Messing, who's with the agency Explain in Portland. And Sarah was writing about service design. We had an interesting chat about design thinking and how that differs from service design. She made the point in her article that about 80% of the US GDP right now is in services. So how we design the delivery of services is absolutely crucial. It was interesting as we got into the discussion that there, because this is such an evolving field, there are definitional issues. So in my mind, customer experience is in some ways broader than service design, but it could just as easily be interpreted as she did the other way around, where service design in her mind is everything from supplier chain right through to the end customer, which is pretty much the way I would look at designing good customer experience as well, because you can't deliver good customer experience if you haven't got all those other things in place. So I think despite different names, we're really on the same path there. And in fact, when I asked her in the interview how she would choose a service design firm, she said, well, look for thought leaders in customer experience. Anyway, do enjoy the interview. I will chat with you briefly at the end of it. First of all, how does service design differ from design thinking? Like, we've heard the term design thinking thrown around a lot.
Yes. So I view design thinking as the application of design principles, attitudes, approaches to solving any kind of problem. And service design in particular is a methodology that looks at the organizational and operational capabilities of a business and how they interlock and roll up into the service and the experience that they are providing to the customer.
Okay. So how would service design differ from design, let's say, in a manufacturing company? Or would it be part of what they're offering? Because your article seemed to be focusing, I mean, you quoted in your article about 80% of the U.S. GDP being in services.
Yeah.
So the implication there being that service design is for service companies. Is that accurate or no?
No, I don't think that's accurate. And that's an interesting, that's the first time I've thought about it that way. So it's a really good point. I think service design can be used in a variety of, like, whether it's a service-based company or a manufacturing company, as you said. The role of the customer does not, I also see that as it doesn't have to be the end paying customer. It could essentially be the user. So even in a manufacturing capacity, that could even be the employee. And what are the parts and pieces of that organization, the structures, the systems, the culture, that is rolling up into what that employee has to face every day and that experience for that person from that point of view. And there are lots of other ways that design can be used in a manufacturing capacity. That was the other point of your question. And I don't know if you want me to go down that road.
Not yet. But tell me a little bit about the challenge. Like, how do you approach an issue? Let's say you've got a company that recognizes it has a problem. How do you even approach it? Where do you start?
The diagnosis of the problem is always a good place to start. And ensuring that if the company has recognized that there's a problem, do all the key stakeholders that are engaged in that problem see it the same way? So we work a lot on stakeholder alignment, and that's where one of the tools of design thinking that we use is visuals and really getting people to draw out their mental models, literally into a diagram or something that is a sketch, to actually see that or to showcase the fact that even though we all say we recognize this problem, we're all coming at it with our different points of view, particularly with different roles that have different visibility within the organization. And so it becomes a very multifaceted challenge. So it's really having the correct frame on what problem you're trying to solve and why.
That's an interesting concept. So what is it that you have them sketch out, how they think the process works from beginning to end?
It's usually will take the form of a story. Often getting clarity on who is the target, I don't want to say target audience, but like who is the audience that is most impacted by this challenge? Is it the fact that sales are down and therefore, you know, it's our shareholders that like this is the impacted audience over here? Kind of having clients draw a storyboard of, you know, well, sometimes it ends up being more like a workflow sometimes, because that's what business people can, you know, when they say draw, they're like, okay, I can do arrows.
Right. I can stick people too.
Stick people in arrows, and they're like, that's great. Yeah. But I think, you know, it's always interesting to get a variety of stakeholders in the room that are at different levels, because they will often, you know, some will have a more structural slant. Some will say, you know, our product is not, you know, we talk about it aspirationally and we're not really speaking honestly that it's not the best product on the market, something like that.
Hmm.
So, yeah, it's a cool experience.
One of the things that I come across, and I'm sure you've come across a lot, is the barriers, the silos, and just resistance to actually cooperating, working together. How do you deal with that? I'm thinking that's probably something we see pretty often.
Yeah, that is a huge obstacle, and it's something that we try to do a lot of upfront kind of qualifying of how we are going to approach this. And although it doesn't really matter how much you say, like, this is truly collaborative, like, truly, truly, we really have to have everybody together, and we're going to be in person, and we're going to be, you know, with post-it notes for like a week, you know, there's still sometimes resistance. But I think one of the biggest approaches that I've seen within that frame, one of the biggest tools that has been most effective is really, it's actually kind of coming in with the designer's attitude, is more how I would phrase it, of this is co-creative. And I actually prefer that term over collaboration, because collaboration gets into like business jargon.
Okay.
And it means that like we are not going to create anything new, anything different than what you already have, which are your silos that are not working for you, unless we're doing this together. And unless, you know, this department talks to that department. And not only I think is that added, that's a I think that's a cornerstone of a lot of designers. But the other thing about that is it's really inviting all of the voices to the table and maybe empowering people who don't often get to be heard within their organization. And what we find is that people help what they support build. So, you know, you kind of, and that is another reason why it becomes so critical to ensure that we have the right people in the room, because you really have to have people who will go out and be ambassadors and be able to create that experience again with other people who might not have been able to be there, and to continue that attitude and that kind of open transparency about, like, we're in this together.
So would it typically start then with the CEO?
You know, it's interesting. I used to think so. But I have learned that it's sometimes more helpful to have maybe the rest of the leadership team without the CEO in the room, or even one level down, depending on how strong those personalities are, because you really also need to create a safe environment where everybody feels like they can share authentically. And sometimes with the CEO in the room, no matter how good of relationships he or she has with everyone, some people won't speak up.
Fair enough, yeah. And then also, I mean, you talked earlier about having people from all levels. So how do you get to the point where junior staff feel that they can speak up in front of these senior staff?
Yeah, that's really something, again, that we try to put as a baseline from the very beginning. And in fact, I've insisted when we hold, like, workshops, that if it's a change management initiative of some kind, and essentially everybody's jobs will be changing, and so it's a behavior change exercise, the management team that we're working with, on one level, they think what we're doing is producing, like, a communications piece that's going to help them deliver the message of why everybody's jobs are changing. But what we think that we're doing, and ultimately we all, you know, the management, you know, clients usually come to this realization as well, is creating that experience where people support what they help build. It's really creating that alignment. So we will not schedule sessions unless we have the represented audience in the room. So I guess one example is we just recently did a workshop for a large retail chain, and the target audience was really the retail staff, the sales associate staff, and they weren't going to have any of them in the room. And so, you know, so there were only two, and the rest of the, you know, and they don't typically, you know, ever go to corporate headquarters, and everybody else in the room, we had a speech writer for the CEO in the room and lots of other different levels. And I think it takes our client sponsor getting on board with having them in the room and, you know, relaying that message to the rest of the team. And then it takes our team really encouraging them. And, you know, we also have a lot of fun in our sessions, and we use humor a lot to just kind of say that, like, this is what we're here to do. It's we're creating something new, which can actually be really fun.
Do you find that there are certain sizes of companies that this will work better for than others?
That's a great question. I don't think I have been exposed yet to enough variety of sizes to have direct experience with that. But my sense is that yes, we at Explain tend to work with larger corporate entities. And I mean, some of the smaller to medium-sized businesses, I think, could certainly use it as well. And I think even, you know, I mean, startups often do this on their own without a whole lot of structure.
Sure. Yeah, I'm intrigued by the question of sort of the mid-sized companies, or when startups get to the point where they're starting to need process and how they make that transition, because I think a lot of them fail at that point.
Yeah, agreed.
Well, I was going to say, on the other hand, with really large corporations, I mean, I've seen huge banks and stuff try to do major change initiatives, and it's really rare that these things seem to succeed. So tell me more about that.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely the, God, I forget who it called. John Cotter, I think, has the stat that it's like 70% of change initiatives fail.
Right.
So it's been an interesting experiment for me and my current company Explain to kind of dabble more in the change management space, because we see ourselves very differently than typical change management consultancies. We don't really identify ourselves with that, yet it seems that this service design approach lends itself very well to, you know, all of those foundational layers that you need in a successful change initiative.
Right.
So what we've seen, I mean, even amongst our own client engagements, sometimes it can be a mixed bag because there are so many variable factors that are outside of our control. But I think the ones that have succeeded are basically when there's a recognition on the client side that they need to set up a structure around this to maintain this. So another example is a different retail chain. We don't work with only retail. These are just the examples that I'm thinking of. They wanted us to come in and like diagnose and assess how they were handling their customer experience. And they, out of our work, ended up hiring a chief customer experience officer. So that was a great validation of our work because it showed that, like, they saw the need to continue doing this on an ongoing basis. And maybe that's what I would say ultimately is that we're dealing with human beings, and there's never going to be a time when it's like we've flipped the switch and the change is now on. And so I think sometimes, particularly, you know, getting caught up in very traditional business metrics isn't necessarily going to lead us down the path that is going to lead to the most value for our organization, because I think it is that recognition of our organizations are made of people and human beings. And I think a lot about the who will be the first person to like put a stake in the ground of like the metrics of innovation or like the metrics of design thinking, because I think they'll be different than just kind of straight ROI.
So what kind of metrics do you think would be more appropriate?
I think they'll be more like leading indicators and things that are not black and white, but that doesn't mean that they're not trackable or concrete. You know, how can we measure co-creation ongoingly? You know, if that is a behavior that it's measuring behavior. Well, yeah. So there's some change consultancies who do measure behavior. I mean, it's always quantitative. So I know there's people out there doing it. I haven't seen any design firms necessarily tackle it. And I think there's something that a design firm or designer mentality brings that it's just a bit more holistic, I guess.
How do you or your clients measure success or even progress?
We always circle back to like the core objectives that they were trying to solve for.
Okay.
But I think over the course of working together, we often uncover, you know, deeper, like more long-term goals that would truly drive more value. And it's kind of at that deeper level that I don't think anybody has cracked that nut yet. But for us, I mean, it's often, you know, for example, in the change initiative where they were aiming at the sales associates in the retail stores, we are producing a physical artifact on one level, and that is going to be a communications piece that will go out to all employees, you know, nationwide. And so it's like, well, you know, what evidence is there that that piece has been used? Is it hanging in cubicles or people passing it around? Has it been shared over email? So things, which I guess is similar to, it's like a physical manifestation of what you're hoping for are conversations about what is happening and what one's role is within that.
You talk about co-creation, and when I was thinking co-creation, I was thinking with the ultimate users or clients or customers, mm-hmm. whereas it seems like you're using co-creation more internally, or are you talking about both?
Both.
Okay. how do you overcome the cynicism that must exist in a lot of companies where they've been through round after round after round of change initiatives? We're going to do this. It's going to be great.
Yeah, flavor of the month.
Yeah, exactly. How do you overcome that?
A lot of it is sometimes you don't, and you just have to call a spade a spade.
Okay.
And I think the times when we have successfully overcome it, it's really in kind of just listening and hearing it, because often there's a lot of frustration underneath that. I mean, and everybody has a theory for, you know, why this didn't work, and you know, and there's a lot of useful information to be gained from listening to, you know, the different dynamics within an organization that have caused, you know, particularly if so many people at different levels are becoming very vocal, you know, that's a really important thing to listen to. Other than kind of listening and, you know, saying, well, okay, like we're doing it differently, which of course is what everybody else would say.
Yeah.
And that's where I think sometimes, where again, I think service design and customer experience is such a useful methodology, because someone has to experience the way that this is different. And I think that's why, like, in-person workshops or anything that we can, it's not, you know, plastering posters everywhere with a new slogan. So it might be very slow at first.
So how long would a typical engagement last?
For us, it's across the board. It can last anywhere from something that's a design sprint for maybe 3 to 4 weeks to 6 months to a year.
Okay. So how do you, I mean, I'm just speaking consultant to consultant here. When there's so much that's nebulous when you go into a project, how the heck do you even price it? How do you give them a quote?
Yeah. It is. So there's a lot of scoping that's done at the beginning, and it's certainly, I mean, everything is, like, we have sort of basic ranges, but then everything is custom depending on, you know, what they're saying their needs are, and sometimes it's a timing issue, sometimes it's a budget issue, and if you have to allocate something to one quarter or another.
Right, of course. Are there certain departments or divisions in companies that are more likely to be antagonistic than others? And if so, which one?
That's interesting. I hate to say this, but what comes to mind is sometimes the more operationally focused, which the thing is, I think they're kind of like, in my mind, I see a metaphor of like, hard-worn kind of like northern sailors that are like super stubborn and clued, but like once you get them on your side, like they are friends for life. But I think because any job that is more project management or operationally focused is so much to do with like budget and logistics and ensuring delivery is on time and on budget and within scope, and everything has specific parameters, that sometimes it's taking them way out into ambiguous land, and allowing for that flow of divergent and convergent, and that we will get there, can, you know, that's the most uncomfortable thing, I think, for any business person, and it's having that reassurance that, you know, of trusting the process. And I think, but particularly if there's concern about a schedule.
Right. And things will come up, and you'll discover that as you dig that the problem is a lot more complex than it probably seemed at the beginning.
Yeah. And I'd say, I mean, I think the other maybe segment of folks are those who don't, some people aren't, you know, and frankly, and it's fine, I think, some people aren't interested in looking kind of beyond their role.
Right.
So I don't think that is inherent to a particular group within an organization, but it's just and those people are hard. Yeah.
So any tips for dealing with those kind of people?
Here's an example. So we just finished a client session with a large tax and accounting software provider. And, you know, they're saying that, you know, they offer this solution suite and it's innovative and it's fantastic. And, but it's hard for them to articulate because it is a life cycle holistic solution, and who they're talking to are accountants. They, you know, they only see their spreadsheet sometimes, and this is a gross overgeneralization. I apologize to all accountants. But that, you know, it's hard for, you know, an accountant in a tax department to see the value in a solution that might, you know, also help with transfer pricing between a multinational company, and it might help with this global organization and operation. And so they have to kind of, so we were helping them kind of decipher and how to do this, which is, I think, would be, since this was our recommended approach, is showing them how their role is related to the greater whole and to the ecosystem, and that, you know, it's, you know, we're all touching part of this same enterprise, and it's more than like everyone needs to row in the same direction. We all need to look in the same direction as well, and it's somehow awakening that kind of future looking, forward looking perspective. And how is that done? Well, and it's often, so sometimes it's like, yes, painting this broader picture, and then it's also meeting them where they're at and saying, I understand you only want to look at your spreadsheet. This is how this is going to make your life easier, your job easier, and really like breaking it down.
If somebody were interested in hiring a service design type firm, how would they choose them? How would they determine who's likely to be good and who isn't? I mean, obviously references are going to be part of it.
Yeah, but that's a great question. And it's interesting because I see more and more design firms cropping up with service design departments, which I think is great. I know that there is a lot of, I think there's a lot more writing and exploration and research going on about customer experience right now in yes. totality than there is about service design. But the two are very related. So I might look at kind of thought leaders within the customer experience space and who has relationships with service design firms. And I mean, obviously any case studies you can get your hands on, because I think measuring the results is tricky. Mm-hmm. And it is not cut and dry. And sometimes the results won't be manifested for, you know, it will take time.
Sure.
I would also, I think service design, I would be curious, actually, if it falls into the same fate as design thinking, where people use the term, but they don't know exactly what it means. But I would want to, like, talk to some people and see how much of a variety I get in responses, and maybe test out some of those definitions on some prospective firms and see how they respond.
So what would be the difference between a customer experience expert versus a service design expert?
How I see it is that a service design expert has a broader understanding of the overall business. And, you know, if there's supply chain and, you know, distribution and manufacturing and I see it as bringing in, you know, understanding those operations and to a greater and deeper degree than is needed for customer service. And I may be wrong.
I would have assumed the opposite, actually.
Oh, interesting. Because it's interesting, because I feel like the primary artifact of a customer experience expert is like the customer journey map, which can be very similar or very different to the service design blueprint.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, I guess the way I look at it and the reason I think of it as being the customer experience part as being broader is the customer experience is obviously going to be influenced by that whole map of, you know, what happens in the back end before the customers get involved in any way.
Yeah, very true.
But I guess, as you say, it's partially a definitional question, and people, these are all evolving fields.
Yeah, which I actually find kind of fascinating.
Yeah, me too. I love it. Yeah. Is there anything I should have asked you and I haven't?
I don't think so. This is really fun. I don't get to, like, talk about this all the time with someone who's just into it. So it's been a pleasure.
Well, it's great to meet you.
problem with designing great services and great customer experiences is that messy little problem we call people. The fact of the matter is staff, the staff of suppliers, your own staff, and ultimately your customers are not as precise as widgets, and you can't actually design things in that precise a way, which is why ultimately, to deliver outstanding customer service, you have to get into some of the messier elements, like how do you change how your staff are feeling and therefore behaving? Actually, I've been reading a really fabulous book by Ben Horowitz called The Hard Thing About Hard Things. And he's was the founder of some what became really huge .com successes. And he talks a lot about the challenges of dealing that and has some great advice with that. I hope to get him on the show for you soon. But one thing that Sarah really stressed was the importance of co-creation, which is getting your entire team involved in the process to create something wonderful. There's a lot more to it than that, as you know, and we'll discuss it a bit more in some of these shows. Anyway, enough about that for now. I look forward to chatting with you in another 2 weeks. I'm about to head off to Toronto to help my daughter get set up in a new apartment. She's entering her second year at the University of Toronto, so got some IKEA furniture to build there. Speaking of IKEA, I was really frustrated the other day to discover that, at least in Canada, IKEA doesn't let you order online and pick up in store, which would have made our lives a heck of a lot easier with this move. Just saying, IKEA. Anyway, that's all for now, and if you do have any comments on the show or suggestions for people you think I should be interviewing, I'd really value your feedback. You can always reach me by email, Tema, T-E-M as in marketing A, at frankreactions.com. You can always leave me a telephone message on our toll-free line, which is 1-866-544-9262. If you'd like to check out the other episodes or the blog, visit frankreactions.com, and you can always subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you would be so kind as to put a review in iTunes, that would be absolutely awesome, because then other people can also discover this show more easily. You can also, of course, find me on Twitter at Tema Frank and all the other basic social media places. I look forward to chatting with you again in 2 weeks.